Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here with you today. And a happy day it is. It's Monday. And a lot of people just have to get back into the swing of the work week. And I say, calm down. Just let everything calm down on a Monday. Because we have a lot of anxiety on Mondays. Many people, just to go back to work is stressful. But just know that God is going to give you what you need today. In Psalm 62, it says, my salvation and my honor depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge. I love that verse. I just think it's a great way to start Monday. There's a lot of news over the weekend. I'm going to talk about it with my friend Patrick Albanese in just a few minutes. I found this kind of interesting. A woman said she struck a deer because she was distracted by Sasquatch. That was a story that caught my eye. She collided with a deer. It might be a driver's worst nightmare to hit a deer, but this Bigfoot incident caused it all. She was looking in a rearview mirror. She saw Sasquatch, and she hit a deer. She was distracted by Sasquatch.
At least that's the story we're going with.
Or that's what she has named her cell phone, Sasquatch. I get the feeling she was looking at her cell phone, but I don't know for sure. But the old Sasquatch excuse, still working. Here's a company plans the tour of the Titanic. If you are a tourist and you want to go explore the site of one of the most infamous disasters in maritime history, a London-based company will take you there to see the wreck of the RMS Titanic, which hit the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean in 1912. Cost, guess, $100,000.
That's an awful lot of money to see what they put on a movie screen for like $5.
You are so right. You are so right. And the UConn women's basketball team is looking to punch their ticket to the NCAA Final Four tonight. They will take on Oregon in the Elite Eight tonight in Bridgeport, and the winner advancing to the Final Four next weekend in Dallas. This is a machine. The UConn ladies are an absolute machine. And here's another public hearing in Fargo. There's going to be an ordinance that will allow residents to have chickens in their backyard. You can have up to 4 chickens. That's kind of an interesting idea. The permit application would have to be filed first, and the size of the coop will be addressed as well. I think this is a good idea because it will finally give some chickens a chance to die from a natural death. Because what chicken ever dies from a natural death? You raise them, you slaughter them, you eat them, you grill them.
And you don't think the backyard chickens will meet a similar fate?
I don't know, but I would give
I think you're an optimist.
I would give the chicken a chance to die a natural death.
That's very noble of you. I like that.
And then an ambitious woman in Janesville, Wisconsin, they're looking for her. She stole or was suspected of stealing 700 pounds worth of meat from a local Walmart. I just don't know how you sneak out of Walmart with $700 worth of meat.
That's my only question is how?
I know.
How does that happen?
I don't know.
No one notice?
I don't know. Now, Rebecca, you are a very savvy, you're a savvy person when it comes to doing political analysis. And I have a shockingly limited capacity to understand how Washington works. And because it seems so counterintuitive to common sense.
Well, then you would fit right in because that's the same thing I feel like is going on in D.C. right now.
Okay. It seems in modern politics, it seems the out of power party essentially roots for the country to flounder.
So that they can sweep in and be a hero, potentially?
I guess. So we're going to talk to Patrick Albanese and join in with Rebecca as well on some of the craziness in Washington. We'll just take a short break. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Welcome to your Monday. Be back in a minute. Nine minutes after the hour. Good morning. Bill Arnold here. I was just talking about this woman that stole $700 worth of meat from a local Walmart. And my friend Patrick, who I'm going to bring on the air just now, said that there were 11 dogs following her very closely, which is probably a good way to hunt her down. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was behind her.
So, and the traveling kennel.
Yeah. A woman who tried to jump the White House fence, she got tripped up by her own shoelaces last week. She was arrested days later for violating a stay-away order. I'm starting to feel really sorry for Hillary.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're assuming that was her climbing the fence. I would have thought that she and Bill would have kept at least a key to the servants' quarters. And I don't know. I mean, maybe this is just a mean thing to say, but isn't she, you know, using Velcro shoes these days?
She might be. She might be.
Yeah, okay. She even ties laces. That's what the problem was. She's like, I can't do these darn things anymore.
Yeah, I was telling Rebecca right before we went to break that I just have such a limited capacity to understand how Washington works because it's so counterintuitive to common sense.
And you take common sense, throw it out the window, and ta-da!
Yeah.
I think you got Washington.
Right. So Republicans have had 7 years to figure out what they do if or when they were ever in a position to repeal and replace Obamacare, and they blew it. I've got a clip here I want to play for you.
Okay.
All right.
Obamacare is the law of the land. It's going to remain the law of the land until it's replaced. We did not have quite the votes to replace this law. And so, we're going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future.
It's pretty exciting for us. Yesterday, our anniversary. Today, a victory for the Affordable Care Act, more importantly, for the American people.
Checkmate. Nothing's happened.
It's early in the morning, and I don't normally like to get a dose of Pelosi.
It is brutal in the morning, isn't it? Especially brutal.
When I'm actually heading for that afternoon nap, and I just want to go, you know, that's it. I'm checking out.
Now, you remember when Paul Ryan was so likable.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, he was the running mate or Mitt Romney, and I think there were a lot of people that said, look, I'm voting for Mitt Romney because I want this guy in the White House somewhere. I don't care if he's cleaning, you know, toilets. I want him in the White House. He's sharp. He's got ideas. And then, they lost and he made it to the Speaker of the House, you thought, okay, stuff's going to get done. And the first thing he did was roll over for Obama's monstrous budget that funded everything he wanted. Republicans were scratching their heads saying, that didn't work out the way I thought that might have, you know, panned out. And then it just seems over the years he's gotten progressively more and more establishment Washington. And you know, it doesn't really take a lot of imagination to understand Trump got in because there's a whole bunch of people saying, I'm sick of this. What happens to these guys when they get there? They turn into Washingtonites, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how Republicans are going to sort of deal with Obamacare until they can repeal it, if that's what they're going to actually get done. But we do know that the United States spends about $3 trillion a year on health care. That's more by far than 10 other wealthy countries. Yet it has the lowest life expectancy and the highest infant mortality rate.
Yeah. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that. First off, the high costs, if you remove Hollywood plastic surgery, that's not that number right there in half.
All right. Okay? All right.
That's elective.
Health. That's a good point.
Yeah. And then, of course, not every country when it comes to infant mortality counts stillbirths or babies. Like, for instance, I have a couple of friends that have given birth to trisomy babies, and sometimes they only last a few hours, and we'll still count that as a live birth, and that will skew the infant mortality rate, which of course also skews the life expectancy rate, you know. And really, when they say, well, gosh, you know, this one country people live about a week longer, you say, yeah, but that's at the end of your life.
Right.
You know, I would like those, you know, I want that extra week like in my 30s, you know, when I can go do something cool in Cancun.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, not one more week on a ventilator. So
you're such a pessimist. You know, that's one thing about you I've always wondered. All right. Let's talk about religious charities. Can they take the place of the welfare state?
They have up until now, I guess, you know. It's always one of those tough things because I think one of those Saul Alinsky rules is try to make the other side live up to, you know, their own standards. And so, you know, people will always throw religion right back at you and say, well, you know, if Jesus were alive today, which I like to remind them, I go, well, technically he is.
Good point.
But when they say that and then they go, you know, Jesus would be a Democrat or Republican, I'm thinking he would not be party affiliated. I'm pretty sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they'll say, well, you know, he says, you know, feed the poor. And I said, well, he said other things, too. And I think that the Christian charities have over the years done a pretty nice job of trying to tend to those in need. But they also don't want to just say, well, we're going to set up a system where anybody who's thinking, this is pretty cool, I don't have to work. I was just reading an article in Europe. The welfare system is imploding via the government because you'll have even second or third generation immigrants where 2 to 5% of that population actually holds a job.
Wow.
And you say, well, this is generational welfare that has happened. You know, that's a really big problem. I don't think a charity could, you know, support that. I think they might actually want to say, let's try to get a work requirement. Let's help you find a job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So we do have a responsibility to help the poor and those in need. Is that our job or the government's job or a combination of both? I guess that's the big question.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of people want to make it the government's job because then they don't have to actually pitch in and help. It's like, well, then, you know, just go tax some other people and then take their money and then you guys do it. And then I can sleep at night with a clean conscience because
something's getting done.
Supposedly something's getting done, or I can believe that something's getting done. But, you know, God does call us to action, and that's always the toughest thing. And I believe that there are many times, I'll use myself as a personal example, out of my own inherent laziness and fear of being called to go to Haiti or something like that, that, oh, my gosh, I embrace Christianity, and I might have to go do something.
I know. That's the scary part, isn't it?
All right.
But that's what God calls us to do, is to get out of our comfort zone. All right. It's 16 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break. More with Patrick Albanese when I return.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle.
That theme song tells you. My friend Patrick Albanese is on the studio line with us. Patrick, welcome back to the show. Happy Monday.
And, you know, for people that might, you know, want to say to you, Bill, that, gee, you know, that's not a very welcoming song to play for a guest. you do have to, excuse me, I'm sorry about that. I don't have a cough button here.
Yeah, I do.
You explain to people that, you know, I chose it.
That's true.
And because it's not because I don't have a brain. Granted, that's arguable. But it's because so much going on in the world, there are times I feel like I don't have a brain. It goes back to what you said earlier, that you say it's such a fog out there that I think, wow, common sense doesn't count anymore.
No.
And you feel lost.
You do.
Wow. I'm confused.
Now, speaking of common sense, political correctness, it seeps down into your Boy Scouts with your son. Talk about what happened with the Pine Derby contest.
The Pinewood Derby?
Pinewood Derby, yes.
I survived it. That's all you need to know.
Right.
You know, I'm afraid when they sort through the wreckage of that event, they're going to say, what happened to these parents? What happened? You know, when I was a kid, they handed you a block of wood, they handed you a pocket knife, and they said, here's a good, you know, doctor that can put the stitches in because you're going to cut yourself.
Because you're going to need them.
You're going to need them. And, you know, you carved out a block of wood. These days, it's gotten uber competitive, and there you can spend hundreds of dollars buying special kits that align the wheels, and there are ways to – in fact, I was at the hobby store, and the guy there said, you know, I overheard a dad talking to his son. Oh, here's this gadget where you can have one of the wheels, and it slightly leaves the track, so only three wheels are on the track, which reduces friction, which gives your car the competitive edge.
Mm.
And the man at the store said, he goes, you know, the kid says, but Dad, isn't that cheating? And the dad says, well, only if you get caught. So, of course, now the whole family can enter cars. And so your sister can enter cars. And I thought, well, how are they going to do this? You know, some kid's, you know, in the Cub Scouts, and then his sister enters a car. What if her car beats his car? He doesn't get to sell Girl Scout cookies and win that contest and get a unicorn doll.
Right.
You know, it's the Boy Scouts, and we do love them. You know, they've recently relaxed many rules, and now they said that, you know, if a girl identifies as a boy, she's welcome to go to the Boy Scouts. I I don't know what the ultimate goal is here, but I will say that it's that same old battle that we always end up facing, that the evil side, I don't mean to just label people evil, but what the heck? I've gone and done it, right? But I mean, there is no safe haven that Satan won't try to alter or attack. You might think that he's only going to try to go to work on, say, your religion or your church or whatever. But, you know, it's like, no, he's after the Pinewood Derby. And if he can mess that thing up, and if he can turn fathers into men that teach their kids how to cheat, and it's suddenly, you know, grandma's got a car in there that beats everybody else's, and grandma walks away with a trophy. Now, they did separate the open entrance from just the ones the Cubs scouts did put in. But there were a bunch of pre-made kits where the kids, all they had to do was go to the store and buy a kit that was already cut out. And I said, well, again, things are at work that say, let's take out the ingenuity that kids would have to, the effort or the creativity. The way to win the Pinewood Derby race is to basically make a thin piece of wood and put some wheels on it, and that car will win. And so you see a bunch of these things, they call them wedges, and there's no creativity whatsoever because people are so determined to win this trophy because, you know, my kid wins that trophy, and that is a ticket to Yale.
Yeah, that we know for sure. Okay, now, I don't know what you do over the weekend for relaxation. I'll tell you one thing I did. Yesterday, I watched a little of my hockey team, the Minnesota Wild, take on the Detroit Red Wings in Detroit, and Joe Louis Arena is closing after three more games. It opened in 1979, and they're already shutting it down. It cost $34 million to build. They have a new arena, which is going to be called Little Caesars Arena. That is costing $635 million to build.
That's a lot of pizza.
It's a lot of pizza. Plus, they say that name twice, don't they? Isn't that Pizza Pizza?
Yeah, I know. I think so, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, Republicans nominated Ronald Reagan at that at their 1980 convention at the Joe, and Prince launched his Purple Rain tour there in 84. So it's got a lot of great history. But in 1982, the pizza magnate Mike Ilitch, who just died a couple of years, I think he died last year, he bought the Detroit Red Wings, and to lure fans to the arena, he gave away a Chrysler K car every home game that initial season. You know, and I always kind of felt sorry for Lee Iacocca when he was running Chrysler because, you know, he lived in a really nice neighborhood, right? With neighbors that had Bentleys and Mercedes, and poor Lee had to drive a K car.
Oh, I know. And, you know, they, of course, Chrysler, a big part of their success was they were the inventors, technically, of the minivan. Because you and I grew up in the era of the conversion van where people said, look at that, that's cool. You get an airbrush and you paint that thing and then you put a can in the corner and a little bed and you can live in that thing.
Yeah.
And Lee Iacocca comes up with the minivan, which, you know, the early ones were quite unattractive. But he had that in his driveway. He had a K car.
My motto is never buy a vehicle you could potentially live in. That's my motto.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the default thing is going to be that you'll eventually live in it.
It's kind of like, right.
You know, the person who says, well, here's my fallback career. It's like, just make it the regular career. You're going to fall back on it.
Right. Oh, Beauty and the Beast. I don't know. Did you take your kids to see that? It's the top movie in North America. It's on track to sell over $317 million in tickets since its release 10 days ago.
Well, that'll buy you half of a hockey arena.
Yeah, it will. It will.
I asked my daughter the other day if she wanted to go, and she said no. I said, what? I said, you know, it's the big to do. She said, she's, you know, not even 8 years old. I thought, well, haven't they gotten to you yet? I thought they were marketing to you. What kind of magic do you possess that you can ignore all that advertising? I don't know how she did it.
Yeah.
Well, because you know, I see something on TV, I want it.
Oh, yeah. Just me too. Thanks for being with us on Mondays. We love talking to you, and have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
You bet. It's 26 minutes after the hour. When we come back, Adam Carrington, professor of politics from Hillsdale College, will be with us. He's a very smart guy. Very, very smart. Be back in a minute. Good morning, everyone. 29 minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here. After the news, we're going to talk to Adam Carrington. He's going to give us some updates on Obamacare and a number of other things that you're going to want to stick around for. Be back in a minute. 33 minutes after the hour, Johnny Erickson Tata was paralyzed as a teenager in a diving accident. She is well acquainted with suffering. Here, Johnny talks about what has helped her cope with suffering.
Many Christians have bought into the world's idea of good, believing that God would never intend injury or harm. But experience shows us that this just isn't true. I mean, some of the most godly saints are Christians who have suffered terribly. So what does the Bible mean when it uses the word good? I mean, Psalm 84, it says, no good thing does he withhold from those whose walk is blameless. And in Jeremiah 32, God says, I'll rejoice in doing them good with all my heart and soul. Well, what does that word good mean? Well, simply this, God intends all things for the good of our souls. He will never allow anything to harm or injure our soul. For God has taken away the only kind of suffering that could ever really damage us, and that is separation from Him. And this means that now all suffering that comes our way is designed by God to make our souls great and courageous. And honestly, grasping that important principle has helped me see that there are just more important things in life than having use of your hands or your legs or walking. And that's the deeper healing I talk about in this book, Beside Bethesda.
She is so amazing. About 10 years ago, I did an event in Arizona. The morning speaker was Ravi Zacharias. The lunch speaker was Johnny Erickson Tata, and I was the evening speaker. It went from sublime to ridiculous all in one day. To hear more about that interview, though, you can get it on our website at myfaithradio.com. We'll take a little break. And next up, we have Adam Carrington on the studio line. Be back in just a minute.
There is truth that predates us, and it will outlive us. It's called biblical truth. This is Jim Garlow. Ultimately, our opinion matters very little, mine or yours. But biblical truth does matter. Oh, I know there are those who say, oh yeah, according to whose interpretation? The answer is, according to the collective minds of authentic followers of God for the last 2,000 years, following standard hermeneutical principles. Others will argue, well, it's his interpretation against yours, right? No, the Bible was written plainly. Tearing up a baby in the womb is anti-biblical. Redefining marriage is anti-biblical. Depriving people of expressing true creativity through excessive governmental control denies the integrity of the human spirit. It's anti-biblical. Economic taxes that break citizens' financial backs? It's unbiblical. The Bible can spare us a lot of pain, personally and nationally, if we'll read it and follow it. You'll find more at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. It's 37 minutes after the hour. Got to pay better attention here. Adam Carrington is a regular guest. He's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College. Adam, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay, thank you. Now, Republicans had 7 years to figure out what they would do if they were ever in a position to repeal and replace Obamacare. They kind of blew it, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, what is 7 years? But you're right. That was a long time where basically everybody who had been elected, from the president, who of course hasn't been running on this for 7 years, but all basically the members of Congress at some point ran on repealing and replacing the health care law. And it is quite extraordinary that when finally that you get the chance to, it basically is imploded. And I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that and certainly a lot of blame to go around. And I think it starts with asking, you know, what consensus was there ever in the Republican Party about the health care law, about health care policy, other than saying we don't like the current bill? Being against something is one thing, but saying how you would act differently is an entirely different matter. And I think now that they were in charge, it's almost as if a kind of a bluff was called on what to do positively.
How will this affect Paul Ryan's future as Speaker of the House?
I think it has done significant damage, and I think you're already seeing that. Paul Ryan was already looked on very negatively by those who are most loyal to President Trump. Bannon, when he was still running Breitbart, ran articles. He was quoted as saying he wanted Paul Ryan out by spring. There, that seemed to have been pulled back recently, and it's going to be very interesting how much support he's lost within the House of Representatives itself, and then how much pressure gets put on from the outside. And you're starting to see some of it. While President Trump said on record in an interview that he didn't blame Paul Ryan. In fact, he repeated it two more times after the original instance. A lot of the news outlets that are most supportive of him, such as Lou Dobbs and certain other parts of Fox News, have said it's time for him to go. There have been sources, the ever-present anonymous sources coming out of government, but from the White House, saying that it's all his fault. So, you know, I think his future, I don't think he is immediately going to go, but I think there is going to be a lot of pressure that if the next thing goes wrong, even slightly, I think the beginning argument is going to become much more of a roar.
So how are relations between the president right now and the conservatives that are in the House? Is that getting worse, or is there any hope for improvement there?
Well, it's certainly gotten worse. The House Freedom Caucus, a group of about three dozen or so conservative Republicans who have sort of prided themselves on holding the line against compromising too much with the Democratic Party when President Obama was in, and have seen themselves as sort of the keepers of the gate of true conservatism. They were one group, I think they're getting more blame than they deserve alone, but they were ones that basically held the line against it. And given that the president, you know, for about a week or so pushed really hard for this bill, and the fact that President Trump has now tweeted out several very negative statements about them, that is a problem. Now, what's going to be interesting is I think the party is going to try to move to tax reform next. There tends to be a broader consensus in the Republican Party about taxes. That is something that they have thought about and have concrete policies on, in a way that I think the health care law, I think it wasn't something that the Republican Party has been as focused on. That could be a way that you could find more common ground. That could be a place where some of the breaches could be patched up some, but who knows? Given what's happened here, I think all attempts at consensus in the Republican Party can't be assumed. They have to be proven from here on out.
Mm-hmm. Adam, is the president getting a pass on this Obamacare bill, and who's taking the brunt of the blame?
Well, everyone's trying to blame each other, so you see that
happens
a little bit
in politics.
Never.
Oh,
actually,
I have so much to learn from you.
Yeah, and that goes all the way back. If you read the Federalist Papers, they say that, you know, one good thing about having a unitary executive is you can actually hold him responsible, while congressmen can just, you know, point fingers. Who's going to take the blame long term, I think, is still to be determined. I think who deserves it is that there's blame all around. The president said he supported the bill, and then spent maybe a week and a half. A week to a week and a half really pushing hard for it. That's not very long. That's not showing a very deep commitment. On the congressional side, the Republican leadership, and this includes Speaker Ryan, tried to shove a bill through in about 3 weeks, when if you look at how good legislation is often made, it takes time. Even bad legislation, like the original health care bill, took 9 months of working back and forth, of compromising, of revisiting things. And so I think trying to shove that bill through in 3 weeks is part of why so many people revolted, and why so many people felt that there were too many problems with it. So, I think the president deserves blame, but he doesn't deserve all of it, nor, though, as many of his supporters say, does Congress alone bear the brunt of the blame. This is something they went into together, and so the failure should be shared, I think, between them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president jumped on his old friend, the Tweety Bird, on Friday and said Obamacare will explode and we will all get together and piece together a great health care plan for the people. Do not worry, he tweeted.
Yes, and well, and what I would be interested in, and I mean this in all honesty, is what would be the better plan? The president did say that he wanted health care that took care of everyone on the campaign trail. He said he wanted it to be much better than the current health care plan. And I think it would be a very good thing that if he thinks the timing is right, if he has a plan of his own, and this is perfectly fine with the separation of powers. It's perfectly fine if a president wants to suggest legislation to Congress. It's still Congress's prerogative to do what they want with it. But I think this is one of those where you need to see what are the specifics, because the Republican Party has been promising a great health care replacement for 7 years, and it hasn't happened. So I would say, you know, give President Trump the chance to make a plan if he wants to make one, but look at the details before you're convinced that that's what's going to be the result.
He did seem like he wanted to get a lot of things done very quickly, which is kind of the businessman in him, which I understand that's just not the way Washington works at all.
Well, it's not the way legislation works. You know, he did a lot of executive orders, and this really does come down to a difference. He would be a terrible legislator, and I don't mean that as an insult, actually. There are different qualities between someone who makes laws and someone who enforces them. Someone who enforces them, as an executive does, as the president is someone who needs to be decisive, acts quickly. You know, if someone's breaking into your house, you don't want the police debating whether they should show up or not. That's what legislatures do. Executives that enforce the laws show up and show up quickly. That said, you know, I think that kind of impatience doesn't work when you're working with the legislative branch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think while in the matter of enforcing the laws, that quality may be beneficial in certain ways, a president has to learn how to work with a branch that doesn't work in that kind of speedy, almost impulsive way that he is more prone to do.
Yeah, very, very smart analysis, Adam. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, more with Adam Carrington, or AC, as I'm just referring to him right now, which we'll be best of friends after this interview. Right, Adam?
Oh, of course.
Awesome.
Of course.
Awesome.
I feel honored.
Oh, thank you so much. Be back in a minute. Minutes after the hour, I'm talking to Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College, professor of politics. Adam, I saw a great article in the New York Times about the continuing debate over whether or not Donald Trump was wiretapped. And I went to click on the story, and of course, I got that warning that said you have read your 10 free articles for the month. So I won't know until the first of the month what the story says. So maybe you can fill in some of the blanks.
Sure, sure. I find that I'm much more informed the first half of the month than I am the second half. The Washington Post does that to me, too.
I know.
Yes, this continuing saga, how important it will be, we really won't know till all the facts come out, if they ever do. But FBI Director James Comey came and testified before the House, before Congress, and said that indeed there is that there is an investigation going on of any connections that the Trump campaign might have had with Russia. It's part of a bigger, it's not just focused on them, it's part of a bigger investigation of Russia attempting to influence the election. But as part of that, yes, the question of whether Trump or any of his associates had been wiretapped, as he claimed. Now, he claimed that they had been wiretapped, meaning they were the ones that were the focus. They were the ones being listened in on. Comey said that, to his knowledge, that has not happened. He knows of no instance of that happening. He testified under oath that that was the case, that anyone he's talked to in the FBI or other parts of the intelligence agencies, that hasn't happened. Now, what makes this interesting is then the head of the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, a Republican, said that he indeed had information that President Trump had been and his or his associates had been listened into. And this is where a lot of how data is collected gets complicated. The real thing that seems to have might have happened is that no, the president has not been wiretapped, but that he or his associates may have had contact with people in other countries who themselves were being wiretapped, and that there was what's called incidental collection. So if you talk to someone from another country, they may be being listened into, which means you would have been collected. Now, in general, that means that the president wasn't wiretapped, but there is some concern, and I think it's legitimate, A, that this keeps getting, that things like this were being leaked, B, that if this was shared as widely as some people are claiming, then it could have been a violation of Americans' privacy.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I want to switch to the Neil Gorsuch confirmation hearings, and I want your response and your reaction to how that went.
I think Gorsuch did, and I think regardless of which side of the aisle you were on, I think you would have to say that he performed very well. And I'll say one thing I found refreshing, again, I think regardless of partisan views, is the way he did well. Much of the discourse we see today is shouting down opponents, mocking or insulting them into silence. And the way he handled it was to be, I think, extremely competent, that even when senators disagreed with him, that he articulated himself in a way that showed that he knows the law, he knows how he understands approaching the job of a judge, and I think that he really disarmed any of his serious opponents through just being very competent and showing that he knows his job.
Mm-hmm. Adam, do you think he is, where does he fit with Antonin Scalia? Is he every bit the constructionist? Is he more conservative, less conservative? What is your read on that?
I think he has a very similar approach, which has been referred to as either, you know, originalism or textualism. And what he really means by that, and what Scalia did, is that the job of a judge is not to impose his or her own will. That's the job of a legislature and a president, elected by the people. A judge's job is to apply laws, whether it be the Constitution or a regular statute, as intended, as the plain meaning of the words intend. And that's why originalism means going back to the original understanding, and what textualism means, starting with the text itself. And on that, I think he seems to be very Scalia-like. He says he greatly admired the man. At the same time, I think there are certain ways he might even be more willing to go back to the original understanding of the Constitution than even Scalia. And I'll give just one quick example of that. In the instance of deference to administrative agencies, right now the courts give massive deference to bureaucracy and let them in many ways write and interpret laws without any input from Congress or the courts. And Gorsuch has an opinion on the books as a lower court judge saying that's a serious violation of separation of powers, that courts and Congress and the president should all be much more active in making and enforcing laws and not leaving it up to unelected extra-constitutional bureaucrats. And I think he is even more willing to uphold that originalist, textualist vision than even Scalia was.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. So, Adam, thank you so much. As we've got just about a minute left, as a political professor, what on the political landscape is most captivating your interest right now?
Well, as someone who studies the courts, I would say the Gorsuch hearing and what that will do to the courts. But I think politically, the future of the Republican and Democratic parties, and I've talked about this before, what holds the two parties together and what differences, and I think the healthcare law has shown this, what will the parties look like going forward when there's so much fighting within them and so many differences of opinion? I think this is a very interesting time for that future as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Thank you so much for being such a great guest, AC, now that we're regular
great.
Pals.
Absolutely. Great to be here and look forward to talking to you again, hopefully in the future.
Thanks a lot, Adam. It's 56 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break. And next up, Rod Dreher is going to talk about the Benedictine option. Benedict option. Got that right. Second time around. Be back in a minute. Fifty-seven minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here with you. We're going to take a little news break, and then we're going to talk to Rod Dreher. It's going to be a great conversation that I am looking forward to. Be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.